We're joined by Rufus Hound. This is Utter Shambles with Josie Long.
Hello.
As well, and Robin Ince. And Rufus Hound, who is, of course...
an actor.
House husband, father, actor and mum. Rufus, this is... Because the new series, Josie, I don't know if you know about this, we're now meant to talk about very specific topics as kind of modules. Oh, yeah.
I'm tired.
I know, we're both very tired. We were doing the Latitude Fest when she got back very late.
I did. Oh, crumbs. Me and my friend drove back. And I say me and my friend drove back. My friend drove, and she was driving to Tolpuddle Martyrs Festival. And I was like, why didn't you go through London? And she was like, okay. Yeah.
You really were very cruel on that, aren't you? Because it's not easy, is it?
No, it was actually very easy because I live right off the A12 and it was on the way. And it was good because we had a good long chat. But I just thought for humour's sake, I'd make it seem like I exploited her.
Yeah, exploiting someone going to a martyrs festival is actually a very good thing to do. It helps you feel that you fit in when you get there. Someone of my so-called friends, you know what she made me do?
Yeah. The thing about Tolpuddle Martyrs is they didn't die. None of them died. They're not martyrs. Furious.
Yeah. You're already changing, aren't you now? Yeah.
Big fan of them. Big fan of what they did.
Yeah.
But they should
be
called... If you
don't die, that's it. Well, you weren't committed to the cause.
That's the definition of being a martyr, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah. No, there is that.
They should be called
I don't know, actually. We should find out. Yeah. can top someone out in the booth thing find out what the definition of martyrs is?
No, but they were
No, we
they
should
were
find
incredible.
Out the definition of martyrs.
I did it the other year and there was a rock opera done by children. Right. To illustrate their life. Anyway, sorry, what's the topic?
That sounds really good. Do you know
it
what?
Was
a
really
rock
good.
Opera
I
done
cried.
By children.
It was wonderful because there was like 17-year-olds singing at the back and then down the front there were like 13-year-olds miming the singing. So there'd be like a little boy and like the song behind would be like, I'm going to miss you, my wife. The boy would be like... Obviously, that bit won't work on the radio.
It will work because you made slightly kind of the sound of lips banging up and down to suggest mime. That's very good. What would you have done, Rufus?
You're
the actor Rufus Hound.
Flappy mouth mime on a podcast. Yeah.
Rufus Hound, as an actor, how would you have demonstrated that form of miming to rock opera by elder teenagers?
I don't
teenagers?
Know. I'm so method that unless I've actually had 20 minutes outside really considering how I'd do it, I can't just turn it on. Mm. I heard, you know, Claudia Winkleman's late night radio show. Have you heard that on Radio 2?
Yeah, not for a while, but
it's
yeah.
good. It's like if you're coming back from
I'm too
gig,
young for that, probably, I imagine.
No, you're very much in the demographic. Radio 1 have already said they're trying to lose what they call the festival mum. And now that you're 30, you are pretty much the festival mum.
I do have
And especially being from Croydon, you're probably the festival mum of six.
Croydon. I'm from Orpington. That is a big rung up the South East London ladder. Croydon.
So anyway, yeah, Claudia Winkleman, you were saying.
Because Orpington has an entirely separate reputation for teen pregnancy.
Orpington? Okay, that is fair. That's a fair point.
Orpington is near a Charles Darwin's house, though. So if
it's
I had a choice
near
of the two.
It's Charles Darwin's house. It's also got a 1,000-year-old priory, which was actually never actually used as a priory. So it's funny that it's called that. I'm being a bit hyper today, I'm sorry.
You're quite disappointed by a lot of things. The martyrs weren't
I'm
martyrs, the priory wasn't a priory.
No,
is there
facts.
Any truth in history, yeah. said the Marxist revisionist Josie Long.
Sorry, you were saying...
Nothing of any
No,
notes.
You were. Let's go straight from Marxist revisionist to Claudia Winkleman.
Yes.
Oh, only that I... No, it was a rubbish point to make, really. She does these very lovely interviews, and being Claudia Winkleman, rather than sort of put pressure on anyone, she just lets them speak. And I heard this actress being, I can't remember who it was now, so it's not a very good story. That's why I've sort of tried to stop it. But she was talking about, you know, the off stage and the on stage, and when one enters this sort of what she likes to think of as heaven space. And it was all these things that I sort of, you know, I knew what she was talking about, but it was just in the most sort of artsy-fartsy way possible.
Is that the problem? Now you've become, you were always interested in acting, weren't you? It was kind of a, but. Do you find that your comedic facetiousness while surrounded by la-la actordom makes you go, what is going on? Because I found I once did one thing with some actors. And
Was it The Office?
No. I've done two things. I've played a bloke who doesn't get a job interview and someone who's like a mad Christopher Biggins.
But
that's
also,
my range.
No,
I can only do it. I say range. There is nothing in between.
No.
I can either do quite quiet.
You played the husband of that woman in that film you wrote?
Yeah, that's true. I also played. I've played an abused husband forced to dress as a cowboy in Razzle Dazzle. I've played Nina Conti's husband in a series of adverts to say watch opera this Christmas on BBC Two.
Right.
So I'm very good at that. I'm very good at being locked out or looking annoyed at the opera on BBC Two. Right. And then Monkey came along, and that was the end of it for me. I could have been her vent dummy. And that was a brilliant documentary, by the way. But we'll deal with that later on.
I've heard all about that, but
I've not
seen
it.
I did. I just saw loads of people on Twitter going absolutely mad for it. And even though it wasn't something I would naturally have watched, I thought, all right, yeah, go on, then I'll give it a go.
That's interesting. From an evolutionary perspective, do you think there are things that we naturally watch and those things that we're forced to watch? Is there a kind of nature and nurture in television? Good, we've got that analysed. So yeah. I thought I was back on Infinite Monkey Cage.
Yeah. Which, by the way, is bloody smashing.
Oh, glad you enjoy it.
Yeah,
but I like the fact that because you were going to compliment me, your own voice tried to leave your body. But yeah, the acting thing, I think, is because I've done a few things with actors, and the cliches are true, where when you get comedians and actors working together in a thing, the comedians go, well, I could probably fall over here.
Yeah,
that'd be all right then. Could I get my hand stuck in a thing or screech? That'd be great,
yeah.
Right? And then they just get on with it. And the actors I did find would keep going, I still don't really know why I'm falling over.
Yes.
And there's a lot of it. So it seems that there's a lot of a constant questioning of why am I doing this?
Yes.
And then just doing crosswords in bored moments.
Yeah.
That sounds like my life.
I've just done this play at the Soho Theatre, and I was backstage doing a crossword, and genuinely thought, now I'm a real actor.
Do you do cryptics?
I'm rubbish at them.
Me too, but I'm trying so hard.
I know, that's the thing, isn't it? You've just got to... You basically, when you decide you're going to be a cryptic crossword person, you just have to clear the afternoon and resign yourself to the fact that that is a crossword that will have three... Yeah. Like misspelt answers,
and in
and
5 years,
and then 5 years you'll get four, and 5 years after that you'll get five.
But it does feel like something that won't disappoint in a manner that's quite useful, because you think maybe if I live to 75, I will be able to do them.
Yes,
that's good. You won't get bored.
Do you know there was that famous story about the mastermind champion who, when you went for the mastermind sort of heats and whatnot, they sat you down and they asked you questions. And so you're in this pool of people who reckon themselves at Mastermind. And he would come in and sit down and with a fresh paper that he just bought from the newsagent over the road. He'd turn to the Times cryptic crossword and he would just fill it out. And then he'd just throw it on the table and he was done.
It was a psych out, wasn't it?
It was a psych out. And apparently he'd bought it on the train and had like a 2-hour train journey in, done it, memorised it, and then gone bang, 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 thrown it all together. Psych out!
What a mastermind!
One day. Although I
do that to spot the differences sometimes. Hey, found all five. There was a jug in the one picture and there wasn't a jug in the other picture.
Yeah.
Wow.
I made the differences, you prick. I set the differences.
I am. My middle name is Difference. He said out of his eye.
So we're going to talk about stand up in a while, because I know that in an interview you said stand up was really easy and you couldn't be bothered to do it anymore.
Yeah, that's right.
I know that's not what you said. And that's what you reported as saying, in one of those ways that you immediately look at an article and go, that's not what he said.
Yes. That's the opposite of something it sounds like he might have uttered.
So you're just in terms of being a facetious comedian now doing serious acting.
Yes. Well, semi serious.
Well, it's still serious, isn't it? Even if it's comedy, it's a serious thing to do.
No, and theatrical acting as well, I would say. I mean, I made this movie last year, and I've made a kids' TV show.
What's the movie about, please?
It's called The Wedding Video. It's a British romantic comedy made by Nigel Cole, the maker of Calendar Girls and Made in Dagenham.
That's exciting. When does it come out, please?
August the 17th.
That's very exciting.
You've done about three British films, haven't you?
I did Big Fat Gypsy Gangster. I did...
What is Big Fat Gypsy Gangster?
Ricky Grover, Buller.
What?
Yeah, he made a movie. Yeah.
Oh, I don't know anything about anything.
That's all right.
It's not. I mean, it wasn't. It didn't get the Palme d'Or in the end. But what I mean is that you may have missed it. There's loads of films that come out.
I think about that. I'm just looking at iTunes and
they
were in a film together about a giant baby. How did I not notice that?
Have you ever seen The Baby?
No.
Have you ever seen The Baby? It's brilliant.
What's it about?
It's a Ted Post, I think. He went on to direct Magnum Force. And it's about a man who's a big baby. And it's a really creepy thriller. His whole family keep him as a big, big baby. Ooh. I won't reveal the ending, but the ending is terrifying.
They won't let him grow up into a man.
Well, there's something that's happened to him. which has meant that he's kind of become infantilised and he's there just this bloke in a big nappy. You know those kind of 1970s films that really wouldn't now get made in Hollywood?
Yes.
That, right, there's a weird creepy family, he's a big baby, shit happens.
Yeah,
here's a couple of million, that's all right. That's kind of, hello, I'm Robert Altman, get out, I'm afraid this is the 21st century. Oh, that's a bit unfair, you needed in the 70s. But it's, so he did Big Fat Gypsy Wedding, which had a huge cast of comedians and kind of celebrities and stuff, didn't it?
Well, yeah, to an extent, it was basically people that Ricky Grover could get hold of. So, Taliesa from N-Dubs is in it.
Can I please say, I watched, Taliesa had a sex tape. Do you know who Taliesa is, Robin?
Right. 43.
She is from N-Dubs, right. Or if you like to pronounce it, N-Dubs, which is better, N-Dubs, right? And Taliesa, right?
Although I think she has gone solo now. Oh. So, no, I'm just thinking of you for the emails that come pouring
she was in enormous N-Dubs
fans.
But I did say she was in N-Dubs. Yes. She was in N-Dubs, right? And then a sex tape came out, right, of her, age 17, fellating her then-boyfriend. Her then-boyfriend was the one who released it, right? So then I watched this video of her talking about it, and she was so brilliant. I was so amazed. I was like, what a brave woman to come out. She'd been so humiliated by someone, absolutely vindictively. And she just came out and she was really like, this isn't my fault. This was a very intimate thing and he's done this to me. This is the person who's done this to me. You know, I'm really sad. But she was so cool about it that I was like, I have no intention of supporting you financially through any purchase of your music or watching any of your TV shows, but I want you to know that I love you and I respect you very much. Just incredible.
Isn't one of the rules now of sex generally to tell your partner to put the phone down?
Yeah.
And yeah, because that does seem to be, that's really what's happened, isn't it?
Well, I think probably not. Most people, just that one guy. If you sleep with that guy, you'll film it. But he does everyone.
I realise increasingly we live our lives making policies to protect ourselves from douchebags. And the thing about douchebags is that they will always find a way.
Yeah, that's true.
Like, you just have to accept a douchebag element. That's the world. There is, you know, you can't... For all of the couples that have got videos of themselves doing things to people they love to watch in quiet moments, and I would imagine that is probably, in this day and age, the majority... Really? I mean, is it not? You're both looking at me like...
I like how we're both like, well, I suppose, I mean, some people must have of that nature.
No, but I don't mean that you're showing them to anybody. It's like, it's a saucy thing that people do because we all have phones and cameras on us permanently, you know? It doesn't seem to me that's like...
It's not a sordid or weird thing to do.
Vibrators, like 30 years ago, people just were like, oh my God, what sort of a harlot must you be to even consider that sort of thing? And now,
mainstream.
People, if you haven't got a selection, people go, you're a bit weird.
Yeah, but you see, I think they've become overly mainstream. It's now this kind of... Because I think I told this story about... you didn't do the Brooks sex charity, did you?
No.
It wasn't us having sex with Brooke, the way I'm giving it to Brooke Charity.
And if Brooke Shields is listening, you may want to lawyer up now.
If you don't have five dildos and various other things, then you go, oh, you're a bit of a prude.
Right.
You know, what do you spend your money on, apart from vibrating devices? And I did this thing for the Brooke Charity, which is kind of for sex education of teenagers and stuff like that. And
they're very good.
And from what I can gather, they do a good job. And they've got this huge basket. You know when you do a benefit, you get a big basket of stuff.
Did you get a basket of sex toys?
Well, this is, I noticed, I recognised from
hilarious.
A picture I'd seen
of a
plug, basically.
Right.
And I thought,
13
well... it was very much a singular socket plug.
Brooke Advisory Service sent you a butt
didn't
plug.
Send it. I carried it home hoping I wouldn't die of a heart attack. Imagine there may well be chocolates further down or something of use to me. And that was the thing. There was this big basket and I thought, and I genuinely did think maybe there might be something inside there that's good. You know, maybe they've got a Sapphire and Steel DVD in there, little chocolate, something like that.
Yeah.
And
nodding
so I took
Richard
it home.
Feynman bobblehead.
Yeah, something like that. Richard Feynman bobblehead. Yeah, the.
Take the head off and then.
That was a terror. I liked your sound effect to the smacking lips of mime. I really didn't like that take the head off. Because that suggests so many things that are going wrong in the relationship early on, physically and mentally. So I took it back and I said, well, I've got this thing. My wife went, oh, what on earth? And it's not really the kind of thing that we make use of. And then we thought, we were stuck with this problem. We went, what do we do with it now?
Mm.
Because...
You live first in a small village.
Well, it's a big enough town, but, right, most of the things that we don't use get donated to the charity shop.
Yeah.
Now, I think of all our charity shops. Now, there's the hospice one, which I think would be more inviting to that. I think Oxfam, though. And then you think, well, you can't because it's electrical goods. And a lot of them don't take electrical goods.
But if they've not been opened, will they not take them?
Well, I just felt it would be a weird thing.
Also,
it's like they've never
hang on,
added.
No.
They've never.
Robin, I'm sorry. I hate to see you frantically backtracking after the implication is that they had been opened.
No. They hadn't been opened. They were totally sealed. They were fully.
What I'm saying is, if you're you, that is what you would say.
Yeah. But what I'm
opened
saying is,
or unopened, like, nobody's going to buy
are
them.
There are in Soho and in other areas of towns around the place, there are places which have old books out front, and then inside, it turns out behind a curtain, there's kind of pornography.
Yes.
But that's not how Oxfam works. That is, there's old books outside, and you go in, and no, there's old books. That's it. So we thought, well, we can't do that, obviously. And then you think, oh, well, who do you know well enough? Now, maybe you do, because you two are much younger than me. But I don't know anyone well enough that I go, I know what you two are like, Tom and Barbara. We don't make use of these things. Would you like these sex toys
basket
that I was given? None
toys.
Of them have been used. And they think, well, you can't. And we know some people quite well, but I still don't feel. I feel that would add. Either it would appear that we were suggesting something, and the next thing you know, the next party is an absolute disaster. Yeah. Spin the bottle again. Oh, God. Right. And so it was just this weird thing of what the hundreds of pounds worth. Of things. So we put it in the shed for a while. And then fortunately I spoke to Shappy called Sandy and she said she'd got there a little bit late and they didn't have any goodie bags for her. So, but then my wife said, give it to her really quietly. You know, make sure no one sees. And I went, no, I think it's really important that everyone does see. Because if I surreptitiously give Shappy called Sandy
a dildo.
Then people go, I just walked in. It was very embarrassing. So I had to make quite. I was actually going to leave it on the stage before I said another thing. But yeah, that's a weird. Because I think what you're saying now is very much that's just what people do, isn't it?
I have to say, I now feel slightly sorry for Shappy that every time she's in for a bout of self pleasure, there's got to be just that fleeting
just
moment where
flicker.
She thinks of Robin.
Well, do you know what?
Nobody should have to suffer that.
No, I don't think she would.
No, I think she might.
Well, I think she would if she listens to this now. I think you've placed that in there.
Yeah,
I did say to my wife, I said, I'll tell you what, though, we won't get my son to make a little card for her saying he's a present because that would be a weird one. But no, that's I find that an interesting thing there, which is, as you're saying, this is now just, it's just par for the course, isn't
but
it?
But I normal. Don't think that's the case. I think that a lot of people just get on with it and don't feel... Like, I used to be very sort of intimidated by what I saw as, like, you know, like, maybe, like, men being too influenced by porn or, like, pressure to be blah, blah, blah. And now I just feel, like, just quite comfortable just getting on with it. I don't feel like there's any pressure, you know?
But is that, do you think, a societal thing or just the fact that you got older?
Possibly that I've... Well, I don't think 23
is that old. I think
the
Spice Girls changed it for you, didn't it, Josie? Because you were 16, girl,
oh,
power
shut up.
Began.
I was 12.
You also, were not... How were you 12 in 1994? Were they started... Were they 1994?
Yeah.
Oh,
I think.
Dear.
Hang on. Well, no, we won't
no,
look
doesn't.
It up.
Do you know
we
what?
Won't look it up.
I reckon if they're listening and they're interested in when the Spice Girls began, they've picked the wrong podcast.
Do you know, I've got some material exactly about the Spice Girls and about how before...
Oh, Des O'Connor it.
Okay.
Right, here we go. Josie, good to have you here.
Thanks.
of course, you're a comedian. And tell you something, you love women's rights, don't you? Do you? What happened to the Spice Girls?
Doesn't really we've been
Spice Girls. Is that a question?
We've been Spice Girls. Something about women's rights. Because what you do is, if you even like that, it's meant to sound like it, you know, might just be something you've got something on, and maybe you haven't. As opposed to, you have got 5 minutes on this shtick.
No, I don't even want to do it. It's just about how I sort of liken it to enduring the coalition, because I'm like, I see the Spice Girls coming, and I was like, no! And then they were just there for like 10 years, and I just had to endure it, even though I knew in advance that that was unacceptable.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's like, but there's a better punchline.
I've got to know Emma Bunton a bit.
I bet she's nice.
She's so lovely.
Sometimes I think about how Emma Bunton is still with the guy out of Damage, and they're
yes,
really happy,
James.
And I just feel so happy about it.
And do you know,
so,
do you want to know about him?
I bet he's nice.
The loveliest man in the world. He's so lovely.
What? Tell me more about Emma Bunton and about.
Well, she's just like incredibly normal.
How awful is it that I really want celebrity gossip about? I bet
no,
she's
but
normal.
That's the thing. I don't have any gossip on any of them. It's just that.
And she kept her tummy covered for the whole of the 90s. Good for her.
Yeah. No, of all of them, I've met. How many Spice Girls have I met? Mel C.
The Spice
I haven't
Girls.
Met Victoria and I haven't met Jerry.
Okay.
But I met the other two.
Met Mel B.
Yeah.
What's she like?
Well, she's a bit LA now. So, like, you talk to, you know, like, sometimes you meet people and they've had so much media training that you think I could just start bouncing coins off your head and you just sort of fix a sort of demi-smile and kind of gently nod. It's a bit that.
So are you, when did you
but
meet
I think,
them?
But I think, for what it's worth, sorry, the thing with Mel B is, I think that's because when, you know, when they say to people, you know, the best thing, just be yourself. I think that she's got an army of people saying, under no circumstances do that.
So you, we still haven't really dealt with the facetious nature of comedians and actors. We've gone off.
Is that what we're
well,
dealing
I'm very
with?
Happy to,
no, not necessarily.
I'm
no,
very happy to answer that.
So no, what
Josie,
was the topic?
You've got more Spice Girls questions.
No, no.
Well, it was kind of about the fact that Rufus thinks that stand-up's really easy and a waste of his time.
No, I know that. Look, the thing is, if you go to drama school and I didn't, then what you're taught is that. There's a way of finding a character, and even things like how you stand, like there's this neutral stance, and you learn to walk totally neutrally so that when you create this character, the character has a walk.
You know that with actors, you can really see an actor because of their posture and the way they hold
yes.
themselves.
Well, the posture is all to do with voice, okay? And again, I only know this because I've started doing stuff for The National, and they're like, yeah, you're going to need to be taught some things because you're not going to get through this. If you just go on as you, that's not going to work. So you need to start coming in with months to go. And we'll try and get you to some sort of standard. But it's basically that line of where the air comes out of the lungs, over the vocal cords, that is how you're going to project your voice. Mm. So that posture is all to do with being heard. It then becomes about neutrality of posture so that then your character has a walk and a physicality that isn't just you in a hat, you know.
That's a good character.
Well, listen, I loved you in a hat in that thing.
Good character. If I try and do characters, it's just me putting on a voice.
So what voice did you do when you were in Skins as the careers advisor?
I did this voice. Can you hear it?
Yeah.
And that character was called Josie Long.
Now, have you done any characters that have not also had that voice yet?
Yeah, I do. I do one that's like...
You did Beehive. Was it called Beehive?
No, we did one called Girl Fridays. It was actually... I was really proud of it, and it was such a shame that we didn't make it into a series.
No, hang on, that's not true. You
yes,
did. What
I
was
did
the sketch
Beehive.
You did
no,
with...
No, the Beehive one with Sarah Kendall, etc.
I wasn't
did
in
go,
that one.
That, no.
That did go
serious.
Were you not in that?
No, but I like the idea
I've got such a memory of you being in that.
You think of Barunka O'Shaughnessy? Please say yes, she's really good.
I mean, she is amazing. No, I thought it was... I really thought...
I like this moment now, Rufus. Which one of the girl comics are you? Are you the one that does the funny songs? Or are you the angry one?
No, it's not that. It's that I would honestly have bet my house that you were in that. I mean, I only saw
You could bet your house with me, because I don't have a house.
Right, can we stop here, though, and just say that nowadays, when Rufus says, I would bet my house, it doesn't mean as much, because he's got so many. that has changed with his... that wonderful moment, our miraculous careers, we were there doing Street Cred Sudoku. We were both going...
On UK G2 plus... Well, no, was it?
All I remember
UK,
was...
UK TV G2, that was it.
We were filming like four...
You were
yeah,
on that.
I was on that with you,
yeah.
Weren't I?
Yeah.
Thanks for being
here. The 4 a day we were filming, on the last one, you said what channel it was, and I went, well, it's not on that channel, is it? And I didn't even know what channel we were recording for. That was not one of the better bits of it. It was great, because it wasn't actually Street Cred, was it? And it didn't have any element of Sudoku. As far as I remember.
It was fun, though.
Well, it was...
you had
look,
to pick a square
make me, don't make
board.
Me post-rationalise
Street Cred. No, it's fine, because we had fun. I remember having a lot of fun doing it.
There was a grid system, and there were sort of celebrity and sociological, you know, like societally thingy questions.
Oh, was it meant to be a
But you know
of...
what UK TV G2 became?
No.
Dave.
Oh, really?
That's the channel that they rechristened Dave.
It says a lot that Dave, which constantly repeats all panel shows,
yeah.
very rarely repeats the one that actually made itself.
Well...
Oh, don't tell me it's still shown at any point.
I think I did see one, not like 2 years ago or something. But
all I remember was that they said...
They made the decision after that, basically, that they were going to make a lot of programmes for no money, which is why we were there. And then they realised that if you make your programme for no money and then you show QI afterwards, no one watches your show. And if they do, they think it's rubbish. Right. So then they made the other decision, which was to make one show, but to spend all of the money on that one show and then to match the spend on that show in marketing and telling people it was on.
And that was the show you did as well.
That was Argumental.
Argumental.
Yeah.
Which I was terrible on that as well. Can't act, can't argue, I'm rubbish.
Welcome to the Comedy Central podcast.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I've just remembered. Quite well. Well done for pulling it back to the correct channel. So, in terms of now that you are doing acting, and you said you did the film, you did Big Fat Gypsy Wedding.
Can I answer the question, just in case anybody... Because you asked it four times, and just in case anybody is interested in that. There is a difference between...
This is not how the podcast works.
Is it not?
No, please don't.
Sorry. Have I broken the format?
Shambles.
Yeah, sorry. No, because it was interesting to me, at least. So I think it's interesting, but it may very well not be. That my experience of it was that actors who went to drama school have spent 3 years with everyone basically being on them as like, ha, 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 that's not a real thing. You're just there to fanny about for 3 years.
And actually, it's very hard. They have to, like, start at 8 a.m. or whatever, and they finish at 6 p.m., and they do really, really intense, demanding physical and mental stuff all day.
And that's it.
It's like a job.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit unfair, because it's one of the things they very rarely get.
Yeah. When they graduate, they just don't get. So they have to work incredibly hard. They have to take it incredibly seriously. And if you go to a rubbish drama school, you know, you may as well not have gone. But if you go to a really good one, then they drill you. You know, it's a genuinely demanding thing. And frankly, I didn't go to university either, but I did live at a university, and not a particularly good one. And seeing how those students ran their affairs versus how drama students having to do what they do, I would say that drama students work harder, and what value you then place on the skills they accrue is entirely your own business. But they work incredibly hard. So when you turn up as Jimmy Jokes, who's basically spent, you know, 10 years in pubs and just saying what you want, and there's no fourth wall and there's no real discipline to it in the way that they have had to learn to be disciplined, I think it's troubling for them if you're then in a scene with them and you get a big laugh, or you are given a really sad moment that the audience responds to, because they're looking at you going, but you're not doing it right. You're not doing the things, and you walk like you, and your voice isn't projecting to the back of the room. Well, it's only a small room. Yeah, but what if it wasn't? Yeah, but it is. Yeah, but what if it wasn't? And I think there's an irritation that comes from people who've worked incredibly hard to get where they are, and you swan in. Equally, exactly as you say, sometimes it's just like, stand there, say this, and then they need like 2 hours of conversation as to why that would be. Now, I also worked on this film with Dame Harriet Walter, and she had to deliver a speech at her daughter's wedding. I'm doing air inverted commas. At her daughter's wedding, to basically crew and extras, and we'd all read it and we all knew it. And the first time she did it, everybody cried.
Oh.
Because it was just so you... For being in this marquee, regardless of the cameras and the crew and all of that, you felt like you were listening to a mother make a daughter's speech, right? And so they call done there, and everybody stands and applauds because it's just so incredibly well played by her. And then obviously we have to do it again, so she does it again, and everybody cried again.
She's brilliant, though.
Because she's just absolutely remarkable. And with her, there was never an hour's conversation about, I don't understand why I would do this. Because she's just that good.
But also, so she's been doing it so long that she's like, you're
she's
not
got, she's got it now. She knows how it works now. I stupidly brought up her appearance in Hour of the Pig. I did a thing with her once.
Right.
Hour of the Pig, which is an amazing film. I'm sure we'll mention it on almost every podcast. It's about the trial of a pig for murder in medieval France during the plague years. Brilliant. And I was it was the time that I brought up with Nikki Henson. We started talking about Witchfinder General and Psychomania, which is the Hell's Angels come back to life as killing zombies, and George Sanders has to kill them with Beryl Reed with the magic frog. I think that's roughly how it works. It's probably the reason George Sanders killed himself. Apparently he said, I've done everything now, and killed himself because he thought there was nothing left to do. Had he just done a Hell's Angels movie?
He didn't even know about the internet.
Magic frog. And yeah, and I brought up Hour of the Pig, and I went, oh, you were brilliant, Hour of the Pig. And I thought, oh, no, she's topless in that. Now it looks like... You know that bit where you overanalyse everything? Yeah. I thought you were really good, person being tortured as a witch. And, oh, no, I've brought up... And then you think, should I bring up her? No, not because you had to take your... Oh, what? Shut up! But that's the interesting... The acting thing where... I once did a thing where we had to audition lots of actors, and when you see someone like Harriet Walter, you do really believe it. You just go, And as you said, the emotion of it is fantastic. It's like when you hear really great actors reading poetry, and you go, wow, the meaning of it.
Yes.
But it seems to me it's a bit like when you watch something like The X Factor, and you watch lots of people, and they sing, do all that, but they don't sing the words.
No.
They sing some words,
and
they don't get the meaning of the song. And in the same way, I once had to audition some actors, and it seemed to me that the majority of women, right, their audition piece would be this. They'd do something where they talk really sexually. You know, he's touching me. He touched my tits. His hands going down, right? Like this, go, because I can do that. I can talk about sex. And the men would predominantly do bits where they were really angry and sad and you don't understand me. And that was like them going, see, I can act.
Yeah.
And yet the hardest thing of acting is doing the thing where it's just very low key and you believe it.
Yeah.
That's why I think comedians can get away with it in sort of on film, because on film it's so much closer. So you do sort of, you can just...
Well,
make it small.
The film that I don't mean to keep banging on about this film, but if I had loads of other stuff that I'd done, I'd be able to relate it to, like, and then there was this other time. But it
we
is
will be talking about
thing.
Your Paddy McGuinness panel show shortly.
What's this? You're
right.
On Take Me Out.
Don't worry,
you on Take Me Out. Let the roofers see the hound.
Let the roofers
come on.
See the doofus. Oh, it was just less. The note that Nigel Cole gave me all the time was less. Just less. It's verite. But I just want you to, I would just want you to say it. You know, you think, I'm going to really act this. There's a couple of like big moments in my character of like realization and where things change and stuff. And he'd always just come and go, no.
Do you know one of the tricks for that?
Way less.
Is a lot of people, when they start acting during big moments, what they do is they play an early 80s Simple Minds song in their head.
Right.
As if they're in a John Hughes movie.
Okay.
Remove the Simple Minds.
Okay.
Put a Nocturne in instead.
Oh.
Just a little bit of advice. Nocturne in your head, yeah. Stone in your shoe to help with an idiosyncratic walk to show your acting.
Very good.
No, I think that's because there are comedians who are wonderful. I mean, Max Wall was, of course, a fascinating actor as well, and did a lot of Beckett. And Norman Wisdom once did this really moving piece about being an elderly man in hospital. But I find that I quite like some comedians that when they act, what they do is they just make everything soft,
right?
Because it means they're doing some acting.
Yes.
Because that's how actors talk.
Yeah.
So will you be doing that?
No.
What's it? I keep forgetting that. I keep wanting to call you a servant of two masters, but you're doing...
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't
it? Yeah,
it is based on
Servant of Two Masters, and it is... what's it? It's Two Governors.
One Man, Two Governors.
One Man, Two Governors.
And it is really good. I mean, it is a really, really strong production, but it's just funny. So, weirdly... The question that you sort of asked at the very beginning of all of this is with your comedian's head, are you like, I'll just get on with it, just fall over, right? It's a really conscious move that I'm trying to make of being less cynical and trying to do things and create things that are in themselves less cynical. Because what I found was when I was trying to write stand-up, that is all I had. And that etymological root of cynicism and cyanide being the same thing, I really felt that poison. And then at the beginning of this year, I had some time off where I was going to work out what my plan was, and my plan became rapidly mentally falling apart because I just couldn't analyse everything to work out what was the right moral thing to do. And I interviewed Bo Burnham at the end of... Well, the middle of last year, I used to do this show on Radio 4 Extra, where we interviewed comedians. And he said, my grandfather was literally a ditch digger. And at the end of a month, would maybe have a few dollars left over for a night out. And occasionally would go and see a comedian. And are you telling me that just because that man hadn't read the books that I read, he's not allowed to have a laugh? Or that when he comes out, you know, I should be telling him where the world's going wrong? Because he spent the month digging a ditch. So instead what he wants is to come out, have a few laughs and a beer and just, like, step outside of the reality of being a ditch digger.
Yeah, but also it doesn't mean that he doesn't necessarily want to engage with, like, higher things. Like, if you look at all,
Just to clarify that point, I'm not saying it does, but I got that point that actually...
You can't talk down to people.
You can't talk down to... I mean, I handed out flyers for the Liberal Democrats at the last election. I know, I can hear you...
Sorry for you,
yeah,
you poor thing.
I know, it's been hard.
You must feel very betrayed.
I feel very mixed about that. But for whatever the reasons were for doing that, my point was...
Because you thought they were probably not going to be like complete and utter sellouts. not, and I appreciate if you're a Lib Dem listening to you, you'd be like, actually, they've been very balancing to the coalition. And I appreciate they have done some of that. But with the whole NHS bill,
no,
I just think it's not
all of
enough.
Those things are true. And the thing
is, it would have been much worse. Well, it's still worse.
So. It's still worse. And that's troubling. But I do think that at the very least, that, I think why I feel sad about the Liberal Democrats is that the reason I was most keen that people vote for them was I realised that Labour was owned and that the Tories were owned. So you were just, it was basically which set of owners of these political parties do you want running the country? For me personally, if you've got 2 million people walking through the streets of London saying no war for oil, and then we've still got ground troops in Iraq, like, I can't vote for you again as a political party. Obviously, I couldn't vote Conservative. And yet, suddenly, there was this debate, and then Nick Clegg and everybody was like, maybe the Liberal Democrats. And the interesting thing was that because nobody thought they would ever get power, they didn't have any owners. They could have been the first political party in sort of modern political history to have been elected by people with a genuine mandate for free higher education, scrapping Trident. And frankly, after that, they'd have just had to make it up as they went along based on what they thought people actually wanted.
Mm. So now, it's the failure of the Lib Dems which has made you give up stand-up.
It was a side conversation, but it was.
But yeah,
it
so,
was
so the
thing that I realised in terms of going. I went into basically when you turn up quite late in the day and say, "Yeah, I'll hand out some flyers." What they do is they give you all the areas that nobody else wants to go to because you don't know any better. So I was going to housing estates round the back of Heathrow and trying to convince people to vote Lib Dem with exactly those sorts of points. And I just realised that when you turn up in your suit and you're, like, trying to have a chat with people, they've already made their mind up and they don't want you coming round and sort of lecturing them. So there's a bit of that, that if you actually want people, if you want to be able to relay your message to people, coming in as higher than somebody is kind of nonsense. Then there was this thing about cynicism. The DVD that I wrote last year had jokes that I'd written over the course of, like, a six-year MCing career, and then I just infused all of that with how lost and hopeless I felt, and then that sort of became the tone of the show, was I don't know what I'm doing, I don't think I'm good enough to be doing this, all I feel really is angry.
That's a bit like my show this year.
Is it?
Yeah, but then at the end I'm like, surprise, it's alright.
Okay.
Well, not really, but...
Yeah, see, I've just done this play.
I'm still a little bit confused then by your giving up of, or for the time being, because you don't never know, you may well.
No,
sure
no,
you may well.
I do see it as a hiatus.
Was it mainly, though, that, right, I'll put things into your. That first is, you know, when you were playing, because you were playing some tough clubs, and did you find that perhaps you were looking at the audience and thinking, oh, not these people again? And you were not doing the stuff that actually, because you're talking about being highfalutin, but actually I know that some of your things, you would go out and just think, oh, I've just got to do this because I've just got, you know, get them going and then I'll bring the act on.
Yeah. It's complicated.
Which is why it was badly reported in the press that you thought stand-up was easy and you were just giving it up, I presume, is because it's complicated. But that's what I would, because I think, you know, I know that, stand-up's not, I'm not particularly good at stand-up, and it's kind of what I do is now is slightly different, and it's doing, you know, kind of, you know, I've found out things that I really like and that I want to, I mean, you know, it's like Josie, you know, the without sharing, not the first bit about not being particularly good at stand-up, but the bit about what you want to do is you want to share ideas. That's one form of stand-up, is to be... And I think also, as Josie was saying about talking down to... I still haven't seen it. That Grayson Perry TV show that was done about class. And my friend Neil Edmond said, what was so wonderful about it was he's wandering around Sunderland on a pissed-up Friday night in the full kind of Grayson Perry...
Yeah, pink dress, hearts.
And what he's doing is, when he's asking people questions, is he's not talking down to them. He's actually using the language he would talk to with anyone about the idiosyncratic nature of the shipbuilding, blah, blah, blah. And because he talked about that, he was saying that people were replying this kind of, I hadn't really thought of it like that before. But, you know, when you think about the kind of the nature of what... And that they then can rise up as well and go, oh, you're not just talking down and going, oh, no, you're a drunk person in the street, please give me some kind of soundbite that I can use on... That's another way that you can... And I think there's this great story years ago when Monty Python started on the BBC and they were very worried that they were going a little bit too far. And I can't remember who the controller was at the time. And they said, do you think we're going too far? And they said, oh, don't worry about it. We should always be one step ahead. And I think that across the arts is we should be trying to push people and go,
also,
you might like this.
Yeah.
Not going, well, you'll definitely like this, so I'll give you this.
There was the risk.
But also you have to be honest and you have to, like, it has to feel genuine. So it's treating people with the same respect you would give your friends or give, you know, other people. It's going, well, this is who I am. This is the register that I try and speak at, you know. And luckily for me, that's a really low, sweary register anyway, so it's totally fine. But, like, but it's exactly that. It's respecting people by going, this is what I'm genuinely interested in. I'm not going to pretend, you know.
Well, it's, does the great comedy come from honesty? And I think that's, it's about being honest, isn't
yeah.
it, really?
Yeah.
We're doing something that you actually not going, I'll tell you what I think people like, but actually going, well, this is what I hope people like.
Well,
is
no, that, but, so, is but that this is it? The other thing is you don't. So I, my model of comedy is artist versus entertainer on this huge seesaw. And the artist walks out and says, I'll start that the other way around. That on one end of the spectrum, you've got the entertainer who walks out in front of the audience and thinks, what do I have to do to make these people enjoy themselves? And the artist walks out and thinks, I am only going to do what I am here to do. I'm only going to perform my art.
But, you know, the way that I see it is...
I'm just now thinking that that is going to be brilliant if we all just did shows to singular people on a seesaw, that the entertainer is always on one side and you just have a little queue of people and they come in, you do 10 minutes of gags on a seesaw up and down. So even if the people haven't enjoyed your show, they've had a lovely go on a seesaw.
Lovely go on a seesaw, yeah. That's it. So the point is about that is it's a spectrum. And so it's where in that spectrum do you fall? And for me, somebody like Simon Munnery is probably as close as you'll get to that purity of artist, where I've seen him... I saw him 10 years ago, 15 years ago, play this university gig where I went to this university gig a lot and it was always terrible. There were only like three acts who ever did well there and we saw... I mean, 50
Which university
nights.
Was it?
Brunel. It was the
Brunel. Oh, I died on my ass there.
The
I
Brunel.
I died really hard there.
Uxbridge campus.
Oh, Brunel used to. Oh, you would see me die there then, I imagine.
The, I
remember it started off, it was a great gig, and then it suddenly went downhill.
Yeah.
And you came back. I remember Simon Day, I was doing it with him, and he went, look, we'll just get straight in the car immediately after. He said, never works, don't know what I'm doing. He said, as long as I'm doing the catchphrases, they're fine. And then the moment I go off the cat. So he would
no,
say,
but I saw
and
him.
He'd suddenly go, people just going, and then he'd go, oh, the lemons.
Oh, no.
Anyway, now I'm a...
I saw him die there.
Because oh, maybe it was the gig I supported that.
Few,
it didn't go well.
A few years after the Fast Show, maybe. Or maybe
yeah,
18
not
months
long
after the Fast
it would
Show.
Been, it would probably still... Yeah.
But the kids that were there just hadn't... You know, weren't there for him. They were there because there's a comedy thing on. Yeah. So the catchphrases didn't have any resonance with those people at all. And Billy Bleach and... what was the one he did? The music hall...
yes,
a historian.
Days, yeah. Oh, got, yeah, wonderful character.
Frank Pebbles
he's so
or something.
Good, isn't he?
No. Oh, no, he is brilliant. He had
I
a radio
do remember we literally
recently.
Went straight into the car afterwards and just,
no, it was
just, let's get
awful.
Out of it.
Anyway, where was I going with this? The Uxbridge.
So you say you saw lots of people die. You're talking about Simon Munnery. You saw Simon
Munnery. Oh, Simon Munnery. I saw Simon Munnery die there as the League Against Tedium. And I just sort of ran up to him and was like, oh, you know, I'm really sorry about this. Like, these people don't really, they're not really kind of comedy fans, but you should know you're amazing. And he was utterly untroubled by what had just gone on. Utterly untroubled by it. Was kind of used to it. I think sort of walks around sort of expecting that, you know, a lot of it's not going to work.
But every stand-up gets like that after a while. Like, I find if I have a bad show now... Oh,
yeah,
no,
but
I'm sort of
I think it depends on the situation. I think I sometimes, you know, there's times where I can have a good show but still walk off furious because I know it could have been better because they were the right people.
Well, that's why I quit stand-up.
Yeah, it's a really... That's the hardest thing. So you have to... unless you have a very methodical pattern, you know, really... I mean, there's some people that I think are... Or no one is truly bulletproof, I think, unless they're banal. But there are some people who are nearly bulletproof and people that, you, when you watch, you just think, that's so... It's like whenever when I watch Johnny Vegas or Daniel Kitson or people like that, I just go, why am I doing this?
Yeah.
Because you watch something that is... It's wonderful, it's brilliant, it's immediate... but there's when you sorry just going back to the there was one time where when you go this is my art and on this tour that I've been doing now I played a really it was a Scottish village it wasn't even a town it turned out there was like two shops and I walked on and I started doing my show about science and then I thought no I'm gonna now do a show which is just everything that I've done in the last 5 years and I had some of my stupid books. So I did like a 3-hour show, but it's the only time, nearly every other time, when I, well, on this tour, if I stand on stage, I think, right, I have to do the thing. I'm doing a show about science. It's about happiness and science. I love talking about science. I've got hours and hours of this stuff. And this was the first time that I thought, no, I'm in such a small town that these people have come for. There's nothing else here. It's 45 minutes from the nearest station. It would be wrong of me.
Yeah.
On this occasion.
Yeah.
Whereas when I played a little Dorset town and I thought, I've sold too many. If I've sold this many, there are definitely people who've come to the wrong show.
Right.
And they were the ones who, a lot of them had seen Jim Davidson because he did my slot the month before. And, you know, when you see it, sometimes with the kind of shows I do, when I see too many people bringing helium balloons in saying, I'm 40, I go, oh. This might be not always wrong. I'm not against helium balloons.
No.
But I very much like, you know, the reaction between hydrogen, you know, the whole nature of how the sun remains, you know, so
an
warming for us.
Machine.
I'm a big fan of helium.
The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of billions of degrees. So they might be giants, B-side.
Is that for the... No, it's not.
That's a wonderful collection of science songs that they've done as well. But that's another thing in the stand-up, isn't it? Is when you have to sometimes make a choice, which is not to do things that I think you would be ethically or morally against you, but maybe go, well, I was going to do this show, but I've looked at this particular audience and I think it's only fair because of the environment. Does that come
That is only the not? Same... That is, I would argue, only the same mechanism that I fell foul of at the Comedia in Brighton... 18 months ago, 2 years ago, I can't remember now. But on at a late show, walk out, and I'm just doing my kind of, like, and here's another thing, routine, because I haven't remembered that it's a late show on a Saturday night and that people are drunk and, you know, they've come for a laugh. And me kind of trying to be esoteric and try and say as much with the pauses as you are with the words, just begins failing. And it fails so quickly that I end up just walking off. Which, you know, hasn't happened for a long time. Of course, then three people at that show immediately post on. But, you know.
Well, that's
just
the other
don't
problem.
Look
is... yeah.
It's so brilliant. No. It's such a great thing. Like, with things like that, like, I just go, people go, oh, did you see? And I'm like, no.
No.
I didn't see. I stopped looking at it when posted this thing the day after the end of Edinburgh, which was like, it's official, women aren't as funny as men, with a picture of me as the, like, leader for it. And it was like 3 days after I'd been, like, nominated for the Comedy Awards, so it's a bit of a needless kick in the teeth.
But wasn't he, I would imagine, knowing Steve not very well.
He was making a hilarious, jokey comparison. Basically, they went through all their reviews and went, we've given worse reviews to women than men, therefore women must be worse than men. It was like, that's not wonderfully scientific as a system. That might say more about you than it does about women.
I would argue, at least, though, in terms of that there's a slight tongue-in-cheekness because...
I know, but it's tiring. I can't doing me that.
Especially
when it's a big picture of your face, which are like, women aren't funny. I'm like, oh, no thanks, mate.
Yeah.
See ya.
No, that debate I'd as well as a female comic of... is must get so it's deeply
boring.
Tedious.
But,
so did you
I'd
read Rob Delaney's thing about it recently?
No.
Oh, Google it.
Is it good?
Rob Delaney, women aren't funny.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that. Well, there's a good thing yesterday, though. There was, or obviously not yesterday for people who are listening now, but there was a thing in the newspaper about the fact that women seem to have higher IQs than men. Now, of course, actually, IQ
tests
are...
And were they like, the tests must be flawed?
Well, that's it. IQ tests are extremely debatable, but that doesn't matter. The fun of seeing really angry men go, well, this is typical of the fact that we live now in a world entirely controlled by women, which we do as long as you don't use evidence as your benchmark of it.
And
I like that moment that
women.
When you get that weird thing that, you know, normally I'm sure some of those men were going, no, I do actually see that there is a racial difference in IQs, that's very good. Women are not with that IQ test. And it's like, I was thinking the other day, someone that I once argued with about climate change, and they said, you know, we've really got to wait until we really know. And I went, well, sometimes you've just got to go, well, 98% of climate scientists think this, and it seems we should do something. And that they are often the same people, this person in particular, who went, you know, with terrorism act, it's just that sometimes you just can't take the risk. And you go, hang on, yeah, make your mind up. Look, are we going to go, right, we can't take the risk, and that means then doing something, you know, major about climate change, and then you can also have your rule there and going, he did look at an odd way,
yeah,
and he had a bag that was all... You know the way that sometimes bags can look bomb lumpy? It looked bomb lumpy as a bag, you know. But this is going back again to the stand-up thing, which is where do you, you know, that decision, because in one way, I'm just out there to entertain, is sometimes I think with modern clubs, there are people just sit back and they go, right, entertain me. And you think, well, when you go and see something, when you go and see anything, when you go and see a play, when you go and see stand-up, when you go and see a band, I think there is an acceptance that also you should expect the audience to lean forward and go, I am reasonably open also. Mm. To, well, so look, what's the balance there?
I would suggest, I'm sat in a room with Robin Ince and Josie Long, and that if...
That's correct. That is a correct suggestion.
If there are two
empiricism
people...
rules.
If there are two people I would suggest are demonstrably working...
I was worried that you were going to be too highbrow about us. Anyway, sorry.
Well, no, but who have demonstrably sort of taken a different route with comedy, then I would think that the two of you are probably it. That what you have sought to do, is, you know, you're saying that you don't do stand-up very well and now your shows aren't really stand-up. But you've got to that by dint of being a stand-up comedian. Your process has been to be a stand-up comedian and do loads of other things besides. And now you're at this other point where you kind of self-define what you do not as stand-up. You are a stand-up comedian. And in the same way that I would humbly suggest Stuart Lee refers to himself as a stand-up comedian, because when people say, is what you do really stand-up, though, or is it performance art? He's like, up your bum. I'm a stand-up comedian. There's something noble in doing
this
that.
This is what I really think
but
about
you've
stand-up.
Built your, you've built the people who want to come and see you. Like, I've had conversations with you where you've played clubs, Saturday night clubs. And you'll be the first to say, I don't know why I do them, I die on my hole, they don't like me, I don't know why I'm there.
Yeah, I try really hard though, but I don't do them anymore because I would rather perform my shows and try and round up a crowd to see my shows
right
on my terms.
But
what I
hang
think
on, wait, let me just finish this one point. No, I know your point will
let
be more interesting.
One point,
no,
wait,
I'll finish this one point,
no, it won't.
Which is that for all of the people out there who refer to themselves as stand-up comedians, you've got your handful... Well, you've probably got three handfuls now that are doing theatre tours. You've got a handful that are doing arenas. Mm-hmm. And actually, the thousands, and maybe only a few thousands below that, who would say they are a professional comedian, are playing those clubs.
Yeah, and that's really, really hard, I think.
And those clubs are full of people who have paid their money to laugh in the company of others in a way that the people who you have... gallantly, heroically, but you've built your crowds to come to your shows. You found the people who do want to lean forward, to have some sort of mental nutrition. Whereas actually, that isn't true of the majority of businesses that are built to provide product to customers.
Yeah, I think definitely those businesses condition people, but I would say that most people, all they need is a certain type of compere or a certain type of room. And most audiences, I mean, not if everyone is completely pissed up and everyone is part of a party, but I think most audiences, if they were groups of smaller groups, if they have the right compare, could be open to anything. And if they have the right room set up, almost. But all I was going to say about...
But those rooms are small rooms, are they not? It's about intimacy.
No. I don't think it is. I think it's just about
No, I'm asking.
But yeah. This is what I think about comedy. And like saying I'm a stand-up is my opinion of stand-up comedy is that it is a massively diverse genre. And that what's so wonderful about it is it's anything you can get away with. It's like the term art. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like visual art, you know. It's like... anything you can get away with, if you mean it, is stand-up to me. And that's what I think is so wonderful. And I think that you can really have both things. You can be really stupid and really, really artistic and muck, and you can really engage the crowd and really step away from the crowd all within, you know, an hour or within 10 minutes and stuff. But I'd also say, like, I think it is very... I have lots of friends who are stand-ups who, like, struggle more than I do... in terms of having to do clubs that they don't feel comfortable doing. And I feel like lucky every day that I've managed not to have to do that at the moment. Like, but I also think that, like, what's great about licensing laws in this country is that anyone could set up a gig above a pub And if they run that, and if they run it, you know, just their own gig,
yeah,
that can be almost a living if you're really, really thrifty about it. And then if you start doing that, you know, maybe you run a few gigs above pubs that you do. I mean, it's tiring, but, like, you can find a way to build your own crowd, and you can find a way to do your own path, and especially more now than ever in terms of, like, Twitter and yeah, YouTube subscribers, like, things like that. You really can do it a certain way, but it just involves not compromising.
I think it goes back to that thing as well, though, that which is
but life is
about
compromise.
Maybe your life, my life is an exotic bird.
But I think there is that thing as well, which is, again, no, going back to the stand-up thing, where it's such a big world again now that there's no point in going, you're either fanning or you're not. Is you go, there's different types. You don't go, I'll tell you, music that's rubbish is jazz. What you mean is you don't like jazz.
Yeah.
And that's and so I think, and also, of course, in the club circuit, we should be careful not to say that everyone there just it kind of demeans themselves.
Because
there
are incredible
certain acts that are perfect for being able to bridge. I mean, I always go back to thinking about Ian Stone, who I think as a club comic is someone who is an impeccable club comic, who does stuff that he obviously wants to do, talks about politics and whatever, and I've very rarely seen, you know, have a bad gig.
Well, people know about Milton Jones now, but I mean, 3 or 4 years ago, I mean, I'm sure Milton Jones fans would be like, no, don't be like that, but like, I can't remember when he did his first tour, when it suddenly really broke for him, when he was suddenly doing theatres.
It was about 3 years ago he became really big.
Right.
A tour that never ended, basically.
He just kept going with
more
it.
More and more people wanted to see him. And he worked in, you know, there's
yeah, but that's
lots
what I was
going to
say.
Things.
Like, 4 years ago, I was, you know, he was like one of three acts on at the Comedia that I was introducing without any great hoopla. And you know, just had people, you know, unable to breathe laughing. And there are people like him out there who just haven't had the TV break where people have heard of them particularly. So it's I'm certainly not down on club comedy. Christ, I mean, the opposite.
No, I think it's a weird thing. There's lots of different forms, as you said. Like
not
art.
From my though.
It's, no. Don't stop being cowardly, Josie. Some of the things you said before we went on here. The,
you swine. All I said was, get me a mock-up.
But that's the thing. There's lots of different types. And the problem is, because of the internet, everyone can be equally hated for doing many, many different things.
That's
probably the hardest thing, is tenacity.
The one thing I was going to say in terms of all of the things that we've discussed in sort of comedy is that I've realised as well that it was interesting because you said it's like you can use the word comedy like you use the word art. Well, of course, art would include comedy.
But I mean,
no, I know that's
art,
not what
suppose,
you meant.
Sorry.
No, I know that isn't what you meant. But that's the interesting thing to me is that I increasingly saw parallels between comedy and music. Now, you do have jazz and you do have electro and you do have hip hop. And, you know, whereas with stand up, it's sort of that we've got this idea where there is stand up.
Yeah.
And where are the other clubs? You know, where's the little speakeasy playing kind of obscure, you know, mid-40s jazz in the world of stand-up?
I'll give you the password, mate.
We've got to round up anyway.
But it's
that thing.
It's just tricky.
Things may not always be... I'll give you the final word, Josh, don't you worry. By the way, just so it's interesting that you're doing One Man, Two Governors, which, in fact, the playwright, I was in the same heat of So You Think You're Funny in Edinburgh when he was Dickie Bean and is now Richard Bean, because Richard Bean is a better name for a playwright than Dickie Bean, Bean's a better stand-up name. But that's interesting. You know, that there he was funny, and I did lots of gigs with him, but he went, stand-up's not really quite my... And then instead has become a critically revered playwright taking things to Broadway, where some stand-ups probably going, do you know what annoys me about him? He hasn't really done his time on the circuit to start doing the National Theatre. But I think that's the thing with, you know, it eats itself up, and in the end there's lots, you know, it's a bit like getting snotty about some of the observational comments. I think I don't really mind.
No, I never get annoyed about other comics because they're on the team. Like, they understand what it's like to be
a
comic.
The International Brotherhood of Mike Spitters.
Damn straight. Yeah. But, like, totally. And I don't see it as a division. Like, I always find it funny when people go to me, like, oh, but you don't like nasty comics. And I'm like, why would I not? I like good. I like anyone that I think is good.
Oh, that was my point. Sorry, you've reminded me. So that parallel with music, and then there's that quote by Duke Ellington that there's only two kinds of music, good and bad. And I think that's what you get with comedy. There's only two kinds, good and bad.
Yeah, you're right. There's two kinds of comedy. There's the comedy you like, and there's the comedy
you don't like.
Rubbish.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the two kinds.
Yeah, and that's true for everyone.
That was Josie Robbins' Utter Shambles with Rufus Hound. Thank you very much to Adrian McKinder, who produced it, and to Mike Powell, who edits it.
For more podcasts, go to comedycentral.co.uk/podcasts.